Back in late 2017, an international team of scientists, I think 30 or so of them, published a paper in Nature, the esteemed science journal, about a stunning discovery made inside the Great Pyramid of Giza, a void, a space, something that no one expected and few could explain even if they tried. It was a stunner. Poobahs of the pyramid world, ever protective of the overall narrative about the age of the pyramids, who built them, and why they were built, downplayed it, dismissed it, tried to make it seem like it wasn't really a big deal, but it is, and it might even be a bigger than anyone has imagined, anyone except Scott Creighton, who's an engineer, world traveler, who's written extensively about the pyramids previously. He has got one whopper of a thesis described in his new book, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. We're going to jump right into it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. The new book is called The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors by Scott Creighton. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Hello, George. It's good to be back. I don't think I've spoken to you for a couple of years.
I know.
But yeah, it's great to be back again on Coast to Coast.
Share with me that moment, that article comes out in Nature about the discovery of the void. Where were you and how did you take it?
Well, it was actually in my office when I first heard about it. And, it was an international media sensation, the announcement of this discovery. And, you know, the moment I heard it, George, I thought, that's the missing piece. That is exactly the missing piece that I had, been waiting for, in a sense, to kind of vindicate a lot of what I had been arguing for many, many years now. So to me, it was like almost like a eureka moment.
So in the Egyptology world, archaeology, this spreads like wildfire. It lands like a bomb. Was the paper attacked? Was the general reception in the academic world positive?
Well, I think the answer to that is it was mixed. The problem is they still don't really know what this thing is.
Right.
And, you know, it's such a massive space. It's as big as the Grand Gallery, you know, so it came totally left field, yeah? And they were not expecting it, and it just doesn't fit with the conventional mainstream Tomb of the Pharaoh narrative. It just doesn't fit into that. So this is chucking a grenade in, you know, and it just explodes. You know, they just don't know how to deal with this.
Can you describe the technology that was used to find this thing? I mean, obviously they didn't drill a big hole in the side of the pyramid, so how did they find it?
Right, okay. Well, they used a technology, I think it's been around since the 50s or 60s, but it's developed greatly since then. It's called muon tomography, or just simply muography. And basically, it uses cosmic ray particles, and cosmic ray particles can pass through rock, can pass all the way through rock. And basically, what they did at the other at various spots within the Great Pyramid, they put this special film, almost like an X-ray film, and around strategic locations inside the Great Pyramid. And also, there was a team outside the Great Pyramid as well. So there were three separate teams using similar tomography, muon tomography techniques. And so, as I said, it's like taking a big X-ray. You know how human X-ray, an X-ray basically measures different densities within the human body to show areas of darkness and areas of light, or areas of, dense material and areas of less dense material. So it's similar idea. Muon tomography does a very similar idea. These cosmic ray particles are firing through the rock of the Great Pyramid onto this film that they strategically placed throughout the Great Pyramid and the Grand Gallery and the Queen's Chamber and high up above the King's Chamber and various different locations. And they were able, in analysing these films, these muon, when they were processed, they were able to detect this massive space about 15 feet above the Grand Gallery, and a space that's almost as big as the Grand Gallery. You know, the Grand Gallery itself, George, doesn't fit in really with the mainstream Tomb of the Pharaoh paradigm. They don't really know what the Grand Gallery was all about. But I had kind of guessed years ago what it's about, but we'll maybe come to that later.
Okay. Well, you do mention in your book about the reactions of the poobahs of pyramids, the keepers of the secrets, the Antiquities Council, what's it called? The Supreme Council of Antiquities. They protect this story. They control the narrative. They decide what's real and what isn't. And they just try to dismiss us. Oh, yeah, there's lots of big holes in the Great Pyramid. That's not true, is it?
Well, that's exactly what they do say. That you know, there's lots of these small pockets, sand-filled pockets within the construction of the Great Pyramid. But, I mean, let's be real here. You know, if there was the Great Pyramid was completely filled with these things, it would collapse, wouldn't it? I mean, let's be real here, guys, you know. There's just no way the Great Pyramid is chock full of these, you know, small voids that Hawass has been claiming, you know, because, as I said, if it was, the thing would just crumble to pieces thousands of years ago. So that's just nonsense. And the thing about the muon tomography, George, is that it takes an aggregate density to build up its picture. So if there's lots of these small pockets, they would just average out and basically disappear from the actual image. You know, so what we're actually seeing is a large space, not these small spaces. That I'm sure there are one or two small pockets here and there inside the Great Pyramid, but nothing, they're not a Swiss cheese. The Great Pyramid is not a Swiss cheese, you know, filled with these holes. It's just not.
Right.
One of the other things that they have tried to claim is that what we're seeing in the tomography images that they've produced is essentially a sort of ghosting artifact, a ghosting image of the Grand Gallery, a sort of reflection of the Grand Gallery somehow, you know, filtering its way onto this film. But that, again, you know, it was considered after the initial results. But in 2019, George, I'm not sure if you're aware, they did another set of muon tomography tests inside the Great Pyramid from different locations inside the Great Pyramid to basically eliminate this possibility that it was a ghosting artifact or image that they were seeing from a reflection somehow from the Grand Gallery. So that possibility has now been eliminated with the new tests and done in 2019.
So just the fact that there's a void in this pyramid, people might not understand the significance of it, but for you, it really rings a bell, and it goes back to sort of a central thesis that you've explored for a long time, why the pyramid was built in the first place. As you outline in the book, you go back to these oral traditions that were passed along about what was going on in the world, the conditions that led to the creation of the pyramid, in your belief. So let's start there. Defend for me the idea of oral traditions. You make a point, for example, of the Aboriginal people in Australia and the importance of passing on accurate information to future generations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for Aboriginal tribes in Australia, they have an oral tradition that's something that we know for certain is something like 10,000 years old, because it talks about this, strip of land, a sort of small peninsula, which they could see, you know, but which has now been under the sea for like 10,000 years. But they knew it was there and they could speak about it. And, you know, their oral traditions spoke about this strip of land that they saw. But the last time it was above water was 10,000 years ago. But the thing about the Australian Aborigines, George, is that their oral traditions weren't just about memorizing, you know, stories just for the sake of doing that. They had a perfunctory purpose. You know, it was often life or death in the harsh environment of the Australian outback. You know, these Aboriginal tribes, this knowledge, it was knowledge that they were memorizing via the oral tradition because they didn't write this stuff down. So it was passed on from generation to generation in the oral tradition. And it was life or death information, you know, how to find a waterhole, you know, in this vast desert of the Australian outback, you know. So they had to make sure that this information was passed down correctly and precisely in order that they could survive. That, you know, it was basically a survival thing, the oral traditions or messages that were being passed down by the Australian Aboriginal tribes. But, you know, there's a lady, a geologist called Dr. Dorothy Vitaliano. And back in the 70s, I think it was, she developed the new science of geomythology. And basically what the idea of geomythology is that more and more scientists are now coming to realize something that, you know, people in the alternative history community have been arguing for decades, that within many of our ancient legends and myths, there are elements of truth, that there are events that happen, that these legends and myths are describing in colorful, allegorical language. And what these geomythologists are now realizing is that, well, these aren't just stories. These are actually describing physical phenomena within the world, whether it be an earthquake or a volcano eruption or a comet streaking over the sky. Or, you know, so science itself, the geomythology is now probably the most recent line of study that has emerged into full-blown mainstream scientific study. You know, so that for me is gratifying to see that, you know, science itself is now starting or, you know, beginning to take the idea that, you know, there's maybe actual science locked inside, or, you know, Earth observations locked inside these ancient myths. And yeah, I truly believe that the Coptic oral tradition that the ancient Egyptians have passed down to us, you know, is perfectly in tune with that as well.
Yeah, it's central to your thesis. These Coptic Egyptians long ago who passed on certain oral traditions, you point out in the book events that are described that turn out to be accurate, that really did happen. The big one that you lead up to, without spoiling it too much, is the Great Flood. That there was a great flood, right?
Well, yeah. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, when you look at the charts going back to the Younger Dryas period about 12,000 years ago, you know, you see this sudden spike of, you know, the sea levels. There's this flood incident called Meltwater Pulse 1A, and then there's a later one, Meltwater Pulse 1B. I mean, these raised global sea levels instantly by something like 6 to 12 feet. You know, by any standard, that is going to devastate coastal communities all over the world. It really is. You know, so that to me is a global flood. It may not be sort of in a biblical sort of maybe somewhat exaggerated or embellished, you know, I don't know, but, you know, where all the mountains were covered and so forth. But in certain instances, yeah, because there would be tsunamis, massive tsunamis, a mile high tsunamis crashing over mountains all over the earth. So, you know, I go into the book, as you know, George, and describing the other legend, Egyptian legend of Isis and Osiris. Now, Egyptologists generally consider that as a sort of creation myth, but my interpretation of it is actually that it's a flood myth. It's been misinterpreted by Egyptologists. So, yeah, you know, there's so much evidence, physical evidence, when you go to Giza itself.
Oh, the salt. The salt on the, yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, inside the Great Pyramid, the Queen's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, which is about a third of the way up of the pyramid. So it's about 150 feet or so above ground level. Now, inside the Great Pyramid, when the explorers first went in there, they found that the walls were encrusted with salt, and it was sea salt that the walls of the Queen's Chamber were encrusted with. You know, so that tells me that, and there's other reports as well, that, you know, there were water lines. In ancient times, there were water lines could be seen on the white casing stones when they were still on the pyramid. I think they came off in an earthquake about 1,200 years ago, something like that.
There's also like a barnacle or something that you mentioned in the book that was found way up there that was attached to the stones, right? Some kind of sea creature?
This is at the the Valley Temple of the Third Pyramid at Giza. There's a temple just, adjoining the pyramid there, the Third Pyramid at Giza, the smaller one. There's a temple wall there, and it's got these massive blocks, and this wall is about 12, maybe 15 feet high. It's just three blocks, so each block's about, between 4 and 5 feet high. So at the top of this block, a researcher, a chap called Sharif Morsi, he's a local, he lives in Cairo. He's done a lot of extensive research there about a devastating flood, and there's evidence all over the Giza Plateau that this flood happened. And obviously, you know, the work that Shock's done with the Sphinx and the water erosion on the Sphinx. Right. Now, this chap, Morsi, he was walking along the top of this wall, this Valley Temple wall, and he almost tripped and fell over. And what he realized, he'd found embedded into the top level of this wall that he'd been walking along was a fully formed skeleton or remains of a sea urchin. Now, sea urchins only live in shallow lagoons. You know, they don't live in sort of like deep water. It's like shallow lagoons. You know, so we know from that evidence that sea urchin, there was water at that level on the Giza Plateau. But before then, it was even higher still because, as I said, there were watermark lines found on the white casing stone that used to cover the Great Pyramid up until about 12.
You make the point, too, in your book that the salt lines, that's not natural salt that oozes out of these rocks, and that the barnacle or the sea urchin, whatever it was not something that was in the rock when it was carved, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the sea urchin was fully formed. You know, limestone rock is made up of microscopic, sea life, the shells and so forth. It's made up of microscopic material. It's not made up of fully formed, exoskeletons
right.
Sea urchins. It's just
tell you what, we're going to take a break. Scott Creighton, the author of The Great Pyramid Void Enigma. The reason that this flood info is part of this story is going to become apparent here really soon. We're talking with Scott Creighton about the Great Pyramid Void Enigma. And as we noted, in 2017, scientists discovered this void inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. And it was completely unexpected. For Scott, though, it's sort of buttressed an argument that he's been developing a long time, an argument that goes right to the heart of when and why the pyramids were created in the first place. And his theory runs completely contrary to the official version of the story that we've all been spoon-fed for decades or centuries. We're going to get into the heart of the matter right after this on Coast to Coast. Scott Creighton, before we jump right back into your thesis, talk to me a little bit about the consequences for somebody like you who challenges the official story about when and why the pyramids were built, because I mean that they guard that that narrative very closely, and anybody who runs contrary to the official story is deemed an enemy. I imagine you don't have very good status with those folks right now.
Well, you're absolutely right, George. It's almost it's a kind of lonely furrow that one has to plow, you know, and you're making sort of enemies, I suppose, all over the place, because you're going against the accepted doctrine. You only have to look at, I've got an online forum. I don't know if I'm permitted to name it.
Yeah.
But I've got an online forum at ATS. And you just have to look at some of the comments people, come out with in there. You know, people have a mainstream mindset, you know, just to see the attacks that are unleashed. And the strange thing as well, George, is that the attacks that people unleash on this particular theory, it's always just they're nibbling around the edges of the theory.
Right.
They don't actually, for some reason, bizarrely, they're not actually attacking the central ideas of this theory for some bizarre reason, because normally that is exactly what they go for. But I've noticed in this particular, when I put this final piece of this jigsaw that I've been building up for about the past 15, 20 years, you know, suddenly, I don't know if it's made sense to them, but the attacks are less frequent now that I've explained fully my thinking on this from these mainstream people. Oh. But now I just find that they're attacking just like really silly, peripheral, tangential issues. To do with my theory, you haven't put a dot above that I or cross that T type thing, you know?
Yeah.
So really, really silly stuff. But yeah, overall though, yeah, you know, it's you're a lone voice, because you don't just get attacked from the people in the mainstream, you get attacked from people on the alternative side as well.
Well, you're not only, your thesis not only disturbs the Egyptologists about, what this void might mean for that pyramid, but it goes so much further, and you've done a very meticulous job of building the case step by step. And we're going to unravel that as much as we can. So you make the point about the value of the Coptic Egyptian oral traditions and other oral traditions as having legitimate information, because it is a key part of the piece of the puzzle that you describe in your thesis, namely that there was not only a great flood, and that it gives us clues about why the Great Pyramid was built, but also because of what has been described as the changing of the stars, that there was some kind of obviously something that happens on Earth does not change the position of the stars. It changes our view of the stars. So what was the change? When do you think it happened, and what caused it?
Okay. Well, I place all of these events, these Earth changes that are described in this Coptic Egyptian text, I place these events slap bang in the middle of the Younger Dryas period, which is about 12,000 years ago. Now, Egyptologists generally dismiss these Coptic texts as just myth and legend, but you know, as we spoke earlier, there's often in these myths and legends there are kernels of truth, and I believe that to be the case with this particular Coptic legend, the legend of King Saurid, who built these pyramids. Now, just to go into it a little bit, Saurid's astronomer priests had observed that the stars in the sky had changed their course. They weren't following their normal paths across the sky. And this perplexed the priests and also the king, and he asked, well, what does this mean? And the astronomer priests told Saurid that it means in 300 years there will be a great flood which will devastate and drown the entire kingdom, and all will be lost. So that's what the priest told the king upon their observation of these stars moving away from their normal course. Now, as I said, Egyptologists just dismiss this as myth and legend. But, you know, I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of other things in this Sourid legend are actually true, are actually correct, even down to the name of Sourid, because the American Egyptologist, famous American Egyptologist, Dr. Mark Lehner, he, picking up on the research of a Hungarian scholar, Sándor Fodor, realized that the name Sourid is actually possibly a corruption, a very simple corruption from the word Sufis, the Greek using Greek letters. It's a very simple mistake to make to get Sourid from Sufis. And Sufis is the Greek name of Khufu, who's the builder of the Great Pyramid. You know, so even there, the name is, you know, very close to being historically correct. You know, so this isn't just legend and myth that's been passed down to us in these Coptic Egyptian texts. There's a lot of hard fact in those texts. So I'm thinking, well, you know, if all this is correct, then why shouldn't, you know, this other information be correct? You know, the reason why they built these pyramids was because the king basically asked the priest what would happen. They told him everything would be destroyed. The king decides, okay, we're going to build pyramids, man-made, immovable mountains of stone, and inside those pyramids, we are going to place everything that our kingdom will need in order for it to be reborn after the flood has passed. You know, so that is the Coptic Egyptian story of why the pyramids were built, which, as I said, gets dismissed by the Egyptologists.
So they say the pyramids were built to revive, rejuvenate the pharaoh. You know, it's a tomb for the pharaoh. We'll put him in there. The pyramid will bring him back or help him in the afterlife. And that's the official version. And it wasn't 12,000 years ago. It was 4,500 years ago, right? Somewhere around there? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. You know, the Egyptologists say that the pyramid was the tomb of the king, whereas my version, taking what the Coptic, what the Egyptians themselves tell us, is that the pyramids were built as the womb of the kingdom, not the tomb of the king, the womb of the kingdom. And, you know, these people often criticize these Coptic, well, they're just Coptic Egyptian texts. Well, they're not, because the Coptic people in Egypt today, they claim that they are the direct ancestors, or sorry, not ancestors, the descendants and custodians of the ancient Egyptian civilization, all the way back to its roots, including the pyramid builders. That is what the Coptic Egyptians today claim as their cultural heritage. Now, they themselves only became Christian about 2,000 years ago. So some people say, well, we're not that ancient, you know. Yeah, but their religion may not be that ancient, but their cultural heritage goes back much further. It goes back all the way to the pyramid building age. Now, the reason the Coptic Egyptians reverted to using the oral tradition, George, was because the Copts were persecuted by three different invasions of Egypt. And they were brutally persecuted, you know, by the Roman invasion, the Greek invasion, and the Muslim invasion. You know, so, you know, this is why they had to revert to the oral tradition as a covert means to preserve their history and their oral traditions and their culture and their stories. They had to revert to oral tradition because with that, you know, you could keep your history secret. You're not writing it down. So it was a strategic means to keep it alive, but hidden from, you know, your persecutors.
And you have been documenting how their oral traditions, statements about when and why the pyramids were built would be valid. So you're looking at astronomical data. If the pyramids were created to be in sync, aligned with certain star formations, astronomical formations, and if they are in fact no longer aligned, then there must have been something that caused a massive shift here on Earth, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is a very simple example of that. which I present in the book, George, is back in 1964, I think it was, Dr. Virginia Trimble, American astronomer, working with a chap called Alexander Bodeway. She discovered that the southern shaft, you know, the star shaft, there's four very small shafts within the Great Pyramid, which run from the two chambers, two from the King's Chamber, one north, one south, and two from the Queen's Chamber, one north, one south. Now, the shafts from the Queen's Chamber don't go all the way to the outside of the pyramid, but the shafts in the King's Chamber do go all the way to the exterior of the pyramid. Now, the southern shaft of the King's Chamber, Dr. Trimble calculated in 1964 that it would have targeted the belt of Orion around 2600 BC, something like that. And, you know, this is welcomed by Egyptologists as confirming, you know, Khufu's, you know, building of the Great Pyramid. You know, it chimed with their particular beliefs. It blended in, so they accepted that astronomical finding. But then later, about 30 years later, Robert Bovall, in his book, The Orion Mystery, he used a slightly different technique for dating the pyramids. What Bovall did was, if you look at the belt stars, they're actually at an angle in the sky, and that angle changes over time. When you're looking due south, that angle changes over time. And Bovall realised, well, what's the angle of the three pyramids? So he looked at the angle of the three pyramids, found it was about 43 degrees from north. He then used the star mapping program to find out when the belt stars were angled at 43 degrees in the sky. And he found, using the star mapping program, that the date was 10,500 BC. So right away, you've got a difference there, say 2,500 BC to 10,500 BC. You know, we've got a difference of 8,000 years. Now, right away, that tells you there's something wrong, because I explain at length in the book why it would have been necessary for the builders to use both of these different astronomical dating techniques, Trimble's and Bovall's, together from the same single observation. I won't go into it here because it's too long, but yes. Suffice to say that they would have used both of these methods that Trimble used and Bovall used, and they would have taken a single reading from the same point in time and placed that reading into the pyramids, into the alignment of the three pyramids and into the angle of the shaft that points to the belt stars. Now, the point of that is that by doing that, if you then look for, say, the angle of the belt stars, you would automatically find, that's Bovall's technique, you would automatically come to the same date as Trimble's. If you search for Trimble's altitude method, you would come to the same date for Bovall, or you should in theory, but we don't. We've got 8,000 years of a time gap, and what that 8,000-year time gap proves to me is that the only way you can get that time gap is with a pole shift.
I mean, a polar shift, or more than one, maybe. That's just such a profound change for our planet, right? But it fits.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I've come to realize in this research, is that these polar events, polar shift events, are actually probably part and parcel of the Earth's normal cycle. They happen after great,
stresses.
Many, many thousands of years. Okay. I explain in the book the periodicity of these events at great length, but it's fairly convoluted. So
And some of the big things that have to happen for a polar shift to occur, you list some of those things. There's a couple of them, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Zhanibekov effect, George. Zhanibekov was a Russian cosmonaut, and in the 1980s. He was in the Salyut 7.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is a great story, yeah.
Yeah, and he spun this handle, this T-bar handle, from its mounting on a wall panel, and the T-handle spun loose, and it kept on spinning, it kept on rotating in the zero gravity of the space station. It carried on along the length of the space station, you know, in zero gravity. And the thing is, every so often at regular intervals, it would flip 100 degrees by itself. Automatically, no external torque whatsoever, it would just flip 180 degrees, and then it would carry on. Then it would flip again, it would flip back 180 degrees, and it would carry on and flip again, and it kept doing this. Now, this blew, you know, the Russian scientific minds, you know, what is going on here?
They kept it secret, right? You say, you write
they
in the book.
Yeah, they kept it secret for 10 years until they could figure out what was going on. And the ironic thing is, we actually had the mathematics explaining this phenomena for since I think the early 19th century. The mathematics for it has actually been worked out, and it's to do with the intermediate axis theory, whereby, you know, if that T handle that was flipping 180 degrees is not perfectly balanced, it's not perfectly balanced. A tiny, tiny microgram difference in one of its axes will cause it to flip. Now, they say that the Earth can't flip like the Zhanibekov effect because the Earth is a sphere and it is perfectly balanced. Well, that's okay just now. But, you know, if you've got massive ice sheets that are melting, you've got a big sea, a land sea of water in the middle of the American, North American landmass, and then suddenly that big bowl, that ice bowl, the edge of that ice bowl breaks, releasing all that water out into the Pacific or the Atlantic. You know, that is going to have an instant shift away from one part of the Earth to another. So the Earth is going to be momentarily off balance. That is going to introduce a secondary axis or an intermediate axis. And it's when it has an intermediate axis that the Zhanibekov effect then has a chance of turning the Earth over, like that T-handle in the space station. You know, so...
Hold on, Scott. We need to take another break here. Yeah. That's a good point to let things sink in, because on your thesis, and we'll get into it in detail, you think the North Pole could have been over Alaska at one point, over Greenland at another point, as I recall from the book. We'll get into that on the other side here, talking about the Great Pyramid Void Enigma. Scott Creighton building his case sort of one brick at a time here, leading to a pretty amazing conclusion.